How's everyone? Najeeb Kuda, I'm the founder and CEO of Endless Media.
And can you tell us a little bit of how you got into the film business?
Yeah, my journey has been definitely kind of long and eclectic all over a bunch of different places. But I started my career working more kind of on the business development side of a lot of major studios. So my first job out of undergrad was over at the old 20th Century Fox, then moved to Sony Pictures and then Lionsgate. Kind of starting on the side of the business that involved more distribution, and then moving to business development, and then eventually over towards Slate Strategy, where my job was essentially to figure out how to get movies
made. Gotcha. And how did you end up getting into like a 20th Century Fox? Because usually it's pretty hard to kind of, you know, get one of those type of jobs.
Yeah. My last year of undergrad, Fox was holding a program that they called their Rotational Financial Analyst Program, where they basically recruited thousands of people across the country and ended up picking two people who would rotate through two or three various departments in the studio to kind of get essentially a crash course in how the film business works. And it was kind of an interesting point for me. At the end of undergrad, I was kind of deciding, you know, which direction my career was going to take. A huge part of me always wanted to work in entertainment, wanted to work in film. But as we all know, you know, it's a tough business to get into. It's especially a tougher business when you don't know anyone in the industry, don't have any relatives, family, friends, or anybody else, or any kind of direct connection to the industry. And being a child of first generation immigrants in this family, and the first person in my family born in the States, you know, the idea of moving across the country to work in entertainment was not something that was, you know, realistic at the time. So I kind of decided I would give that program a shot. If I got one of those two coveted spots, then I would move out to LA and see if I can make it in film industry. And if not, I was going to move to New York and become a banker. So I went through, you know, like six rounds of interviews at Fox, ended up getting one of those spots and ended up taking the shot moving out here.
Nice. And then from there, after, you know, kind of leaving Fox, what was like your first venture after that?
Then I went to Sony Pictures, where I worked kind of on the international distribution side, where I worked mostly with kind of local offices in Western Europe and Southeast Asia, to kind of figure out how a lot of the films that were being manufactured over Sony, and by that I mean big Sony Pictures, TriStar, Sony Classics, Screen Gems, all the various divisions that exist under Sony Pictures, would function in different markets. So it was kind of getting an understanding of how the international marketplace was working, which was also kind of interesting because I think the year I started my career, which was 2011, was one of the first years that the worldwide box office was starting to overtake the domestic box office. And it was starting to become more important to figure out how films could function in various markets where there wasn't a dominant English-speaking category, to see how films could essentially be transported around the world. So I worked on that for about 2 years over at Sony as my next venture. And then after that, moved over to Lionsgate.
Gotcha. And then how did it go at Lionsgate and kind of what were you doing there?
Well, it was interesting. I think, you know, after working over at Fox and Sony, which are obviously two ginormous studios, moving to Lionsgate was kind of an interesting experience because it was a company that had the resources and reach, and especially, you know, major films like The Hunger Games that are like big studio movies. But at the same time, it was a company that's like a tenth the size or even less of one of the major studios. So it was definitely an opportunity to get a lot more exposure to a lot of different aspects of the business that I probably wouldn't have gotten at another studio where it's definitely more siloed. But it was an interesting experience getting to kind of get my hands dirty in a lot of different aspects of the company. But what was kind of probably the most interesting part of working Lionsgate, and definitely kind of the impetus for ended up launching my own company, was that Lionsgate was kind of at an inflection point in their business where they had just released the last Hunger Games film. Well, at the time, the last Hunger Games film, Twilight had finished a couple of years before that. So their kind of giant IP franchises were finishing, and they were kind of determining as a company, how do they move forward to the next step? How do they rebuild their slate without those giant anchor movies on it? Which kind of led to a lot of abstract problem solving for me in terms of just having an opportunity to kind of just try a lot of different things, which is one of the things that happened over at Lionsgate was, how do we extend our current intellectual property into other mediums to kind of build IP value? And what I mean by that is live events, theme parks, spin-offs, all sorts of different things. And This was 2016, which was kind of coinciding with the height of the VR AR boom that was kind of happening around the world. Facebook was just a couple months after acquiring Oculus Studios, and every studio in town wanted to kind of dive on this gravy train that they thought existed in the VR world and wanted to experiment with it. So one of the things that was kind of thrown to me was, can we turn any of our franchises into something in the VR space? So without knowing anything about VR or how it worked or how to do any of it, I started kind of playing around with a couple of our big franchises, including John Wick at the time, to start building VR experiences, which ended up catching the attention of Facebook, who kind of liked what I was doing and, you know, ended up giving me my first shot to launch my own company to kind of experiment with new media.
Okay. So what is kind of your company do now, since is it in VR or obviously... I mean, VR's, I haven't seen a whole lot of film coming out of it, but I know at in 2016, everybody was trying to do it, but.
Yeah, it was, the company's definitely gone through, you know, a lot of different iterations. I think we're probably at like Endless Media version 4 now, but Endless Media version 1 was a pure VR AR content studio. We do not do VR AR content anymore. But it was, we're now kind of definitely more of a traditional film and television than a TV company. But at the time, that was probably the first 18 months of how we launched our company, was by building VR AR content. That's kind of how we got our foot in the door, started building our reputation, and started to experiment with kind of new things.
And do you see a side of VR that could still happen? I mean, I always thought like a movie like Knives Out, a mystery where you could kind of be interactive and see different stuff, could always very well work in VR. I couldn't see like a regular movie like John Wick working. And do you still see an aspect of VR into the future?
You know, VR is interesting in the sense of like, I think on a super, super macro level, I think media will inherently always become more immersive, not less immersive. I think that's just the direction of what we're always trying to evolve the media landscape into. So I think there is a future for VR. I think it's just, what VR is right now is not anywhere near what a mass consumer level of VR could be. And I think that is just the fundamentals of what VR is. Putting on a clunky headset is not a passive experience. It's a very active experience. And I think until you get to a point where you have something that feels almost like just putting a pair of glasses on and really letting you sink into something in full six-stop dimension, it's just really, really hard to do VR. And I think the tech, it continues to get better, but it still hasn't caught up to a level where it's completely viable for consumers. So I think there is something interesting about VR. I think we're just probably even further away from it than we thought we were at the time. I think, you know, in 2016, when that big boom happened, everyone just assumed finally the tech had caught up, you know, every company from Google to HTC to Facebook, everybody was pouring billions into the industry. Every VC fund, you know, in Sand Hill Road and up in the Bay Area was pouring capital investment. So everyone assumed that with this much investment, this much entrepreneurship, and this much innovation, we were going to kind of crack the puzzle. But I don't think we ever really got there in terms of where the tech is. I think it still fundamentally feels gamified. It feels like it's still very niche. It doesn't feel like something that, you know, is akin to the same experience as watching film and TV, where it is very passive. You can, you know, come home, plop on the couch, and turn on the TV, and it is something that you can just easily sink into. And until you have kind of a similar experience with VR, it's going to be tough to kind of get consumers into it.
True, true. And, you know, with your company and you know, starting at like a Sony and Fox and everything like that, and kind of seeing how distribution works, and now, you know, having your own company and having to do distribution, how do you see the distribution changing?
You know, I think it's, at the time when I started the company, you know, obviously Netflix had been on the scene and streaming was becoming a more important component of the business, but it hadn't reached the level of ubiquity that it has now, where now it is kind of the fundamental dominant form of distribution. I think at the time, theatrical was still a relatively healthy business. Linear television was still a healthy business. And I think, you know, obviously a lot of those things have changed now. So I think the future, especially coming into this year in 2024, is probably a market of consolidation more than anything else. I think we're going to see a lot less content release. We're going to see a lot more specific avenues and methods of actually trying to get eyeballs on the content. Because I think over the past, you know, anywhere between 6 and 10 years now, we've just seen a glut of content released on every platform. And it's been tough to kind of break through the noise and really have things reach a level of critical mass to actually get enough attention. And I think we've seen kind of the effect on it from a lot of studios in terms of their bottom line, that they just were spending a lot of money on content that just wasn't attracting attention. So I think going into this year, I think what you're going to see more than anything else is probably just a lot more consolidated distribution. You're going to see a lot more specific and thoughtful marketing campaigns around the type of content that's being released. But that kind of also leads to probably a larger question of just like, you know, what are we making and why are we making it?
And is there any movies that you, or anything that you had to deal with, like if that was a big problem that you kind of had to overcome? Just as an example, we had a director on here recently where he deleted all the footage after he got done shooting a big music video. And, you know, obviously you've worked for big companies. So was there something that you really had to overcome?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's an interesting business. I think, you know, when I started the company, the fundamental thing that I think was kind of the genesis of why I started Endless Media was that the industry itself is extremely specific and siloed with how people kind of move up the ladder in the business. And for the most part, it's fairly exclusive in the sense that in order to make it in this business, you kind of have to be willing to take a very low paying job to start with, work up the ladder as like working in a mailroom at an agency, working as an assistant, and then kind of getting promoted and working up that way, which is kind of the way that the entertainment industry has always functioned and is kind of commonplace. But for me, what was kind of interesting, kind of alluding to something I said earlier, is that being a child of immigrants, I think the industry, the way that it works, doesn't always compute with a lot of people who don't grow up in kind of a direct Western culture. And what I mean by that is that, especially for me, being, you know, Muslim American and coming from two parents who grew up outside the States and in Bangladesh and then moved here, there's kind of like very specific career paths that are like acceptable for most children of immigrants, like, you know, be a doctor, be a lawyer, be a banker, be an engineer. And when you think about that, it's kind of like the simple process that you go to school, go to graduate school, and you get a job, you're an analyst, an associate, whatever you are, you're kind of getting to that point. So the idea of broaching an industry where you're saying, like, after spending tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of dollars on an education, I'm going to go be an assistant, or I'm going to go work in a mailroom, even though that is how the business operates, it's not something that computes, you know, with other cultures. And I've seen this from a lot of people in the industry now over the years who kind of had a similar experience, saying like the normal way to break into the industry wasn't a viable option. So we had to figure out a different way to get there. So I think when I started the company, it was with that very much in mind that the normal path to kind of being a producer in this business probably wasn't something I could have done. I had to kind of forge my own path. It was something that I had to be kind of creative, which led to kind of an interesting thing that when I started Endless Media, that most people who start production companies in this business, like, have spent years as an agent or being a creative development executive at a studio, has like this huge network of people that they've kind of worked with in the studio space, kind of has like a tried and true method for how to, you know, make movies. I didn't have any of those things. I kind of had to just make it up as I was going. And the part of it, probably just making it harder for myself, but something that I believed in, was that the focal point of what I wanted to do was really highlight a lot of people like me, you know, emerging diverse voices who come from underrepresented backgrounds. And the one of the first couple of movies that we were making, every one of them was helmed by a diverse person of color. I've made three movies. Every one of them was from a first-time director of color. And it, you know, was something I obviously believed in, but the first thing you kind of started to see, especially making films independently, was that most of the current infrastructure that exists for how to finance and get films made is, you know, something out of the 1960s. Like, for the most part, like, what they believe works or is viable is fundamentally opposed to the idea of diversity of voices. So when I started making movies, I really had to scrap and hustle to find the money to make them, which also involved having to come up against people who, no matter what you try to kind of tell them, did not want to see diverse leads of color, did not want to see filmmakers who come from different backgrounds. They kind of were hard pushing this idea that it had to be one of these, you know, list of 65 white directors that they're very comfortable with, had to be one of these like 20, you know, middle-aged white actors who could lead a movie and they're the only people who can lead a movie. So having to kind of push that envelope, push the conversation in different directions, definitely all very difficult and led to some not great experiences on some of my films.
Gotcha. And I'm not sure if this was your situation, but I do know like a lot of parents, you know, want, like you said, want you to be a doctor, engineer, etc. Did you have a lot of struggles of your family saying like, why are you going into the film business? Like, this doesn't make sense. Or is there in the beginning of the years, how did you get past that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, it always comes from a good place. I mean, I think I'm definitely, you know, one of the lucky people in the world in the sense that I had parents who were incredibly supportive about everything I've ever done. But at the same time, you know, they come from, you know, they came to this country in the 80s, you know, they kind of saw every version of, you know, how the society has evolved, both for the good and the bad. And I think one of the things that my parents said on two different aspects, one, yes, to your question of they, you know, thought the most acceptable and, you know, just reliable professions are being a doctor, banker, engineer. So my parents said, like, do one of those things. Like, they just make the most sense. And then number two, there's like a level of realism with kind of how they understood the world works and especially this country works. And one of the things I think my parents told me when I said I wanted to move to Hollywood, where they're like, I don't think Hollywood wants a guy with a funny name like Najib Kuda, you know, making any kind of business. Like, I don't know if they're going to be very acceptable. It was definitely something, you know, I kind of had to fight against, which I think my solution to it was to kind of start on the business side as opposed to the pure creative side of the business. Cause it was kind of like, a little bit of a compromise of like, I get to work in the industry and start my career in this business. But at the same time, I guess do like the, you know, acceptable job in this business that's not, you know, pure creative. So that's kind of how I probably kind of like straddled the line, but it was definitely tough. And, you know, I think a lot of people I've met over the years in this business who come from similar backgrounds have had very similar experiences.
And how do you deal with the movies you're producing now? Because obviously, I mean, you must have a very good business insight of how distribution works, where it's like, okay, you have to have this actor, like you said, that gives you this funding to do this movie. And, you know, you're also running a business, which means you have to pay people, you have to make payroll, you have to do all these things. What makes you go against the grain of like, okay, it is a business, but I'm also going to try to go away from what they're telling me and do something different by hiring a no-name director that nobody knows or this aspect? And do you feel like that's the right insight? Like, have you felt like that's working?
You know, I think it's interesting. I think It's definitely, I think, makes the business tough. But I think the thing that kind of is the impetus for why I do exactly what I do from a pure business standpoint is that I think when we look at the industry, we've seen a devaluation with almost every media company with how they operate. Their slates aren't looking that great. You know, it's almost become like harder to just find the diamond in the rough than we've ever seen in terms of like successful films. And I think a lot of that really just comes down to the point that the industry fundamentally operates on a fear basis. We're always looking for kind of the, you know, just comforting film that feels like it makes business sense, because the business operates in a way that most films that are greenlit, I mean, the whole process of making films for the most part is that you're comparing a proposed film to every film that happened before it. And you're seeing, does it line up with other successful films over the past 5 years? And that's, you know, the analytical way of how greenlight decisions are made over at studios. That's how you look and evaluate a film. But the fundamental issue with that is that if you're only ever comparing a film to the things that have been made, you're always kind of stuck in the same bubble because you're just basically regurgitating the same thing over and over again, and you're never building anything new. And on the other side of it is that what we've seen over the past couple of years in this business is that the most comforting thing that you can ever say in this industry is IP, right? Like, it's a sequel, it's a remake, it's based on an old movie, it's based on a book, it's based on a video game. It's something that feels comforting. And studio executives and people and financiers love IP for that reason. But when we really think about some of the most valuable IP that has ever existed in our business, from, you know, Star Wars to Back to the Future to Alien to any of these, like, you know, films that, you know, a lot of us grew up with and probably made us actually want to come into this business, they were original ideas. And, you know, they didn't just go off of existing IP. They created IP. And I think when I push for the idea of new diverse voices and really try to push through the grain. My thought process behind it from a business standpoint is that the value that we're going to be able to see long-term in this business is going to come from creating new IP, not just generating the same stuff. And I think those new ideas, those new generational stories are going to come from people from different backgrounds, from different ways of thinking, who have fresh things to say, fresh new perspectives, fresh new stories. And I think diversity isn't something that is just like something we kind of throw out as a PR element, which I think is what a lot of studios do, is kind of throw it out there and say, like, of course we're diverse. We're hiring people of color. We're hiring women. We're doing all these things. But I think the thing that they're missing is that it's not about just pushing this idea that, oh, we're different now because we're doing that. I think from a pure business standpoint, that's how we're going to actually build new stories that could be, you know, the next Star Wars, be the next Back to the Future, be the next Alien. Like, I think that's where we're really going to see those next generational stories, is people who just think a little differently.
And what are you working on now that you have coming up?
So we have a couple of films that we're producing, which I can't say too much about, but we have a project that we're working on. It's kind of a big sci-fi project with a huge sci-fi production company that's based on a short story from an acclaimed author named Ken Liu, called Reborn. That's what I would kind of describe as, it's like Memento, Christopher Nolan's old movie meets Arrival, the sci-fi movie from a couple of years ago from Denis Villeneuve. It's a super cool kind of mystery sci-fi story that we're casting right now, and hopefully we'll start shooting by the fall this year.
Okay. And my last question is, what advice would you give to a new filmmaker trying to get into the industry?
I think, you know, the thing I was going to say is have super tough skin. You know, this is a business that is built on 99% of the time saying no to everything. It is something that is filled with a lot of hard situations, a lot of red tape, a lot of blockades, and probably even more, unfortunately, a lot of not great individuals in this business. So you kind of just have to be willing to get through all of that, kind of keep pushing through, kind of take all the no's, find a way to kind of make it through, you know, the not great people you have to work with to kind of start a business, because there are great people in this industry. There are people who believe in new filmmakers, new stories, and new ideas. And it's just kind of a matter of staying the course until you can kind of find those people and get to work with them.